Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Good morning, Charlottesville. No, it is not Ellen. It is Jeff Leonard sitting in for Ellen this morning as she gets a much deserved day off for her Thanksgiving holiday. That song that we play coming in is Bjork, Army of Me. And my guest today is Kevin. And all I have to do is say, good morning, Kevin. And I probably can sit back, have a cup of coffee, check Facebook, cruise some YouTube videos, because he will just go. So we're about to face an army of Kevin. Let me give you a little background on Kevin. Kevin, is it fair to say you're an addict?
That's correct.
So what I like to do whenever I get to sit in these chairs is I like to bring in people who are doing great things, who have done great things, and sometimes have done some not so great things, but are on the path to redemption, on the path to giving back, and on the path to making this city a better place for those who are marginalized and those who don't necessarily have all the gifts and privilege that someone looks like me may have. And I like to bring some folks like that in here every now and then and just hear what they're doing. Kevin, I offered to change his name to protect the innocent and the not so innocent.
Right.
But he did not. He elected to go with his own name because he owns it. He says, I did what I did. I am who I am, and I'm going where I'm going.
For sure.
So, Kevin, get a little closer to the mic.
Okay.
Good morning, young man.
Hey, good morning, Jeff. What's happening, man?
It's a long time coming to get you in here.
Oh, very, very long time coming. From the very beginning, from the onset of this right here, we said, hey, is it safe to say that you're an addict? Yes, I am. However, I am a recovering addict.
Damn right you are.
Yes, I am.
2 years, 2 months?
2 years, 2 months, 24 days.
The only reason I knew it was 2 months is because I had the great privilege of going to your drug court graduation.
For sure.
A month ago?
For sure.
And for those of you out there who have not been to a drug court graduation, I would recommend it highly. I've had the pleasure of giving the commencement speech a couple times there, and every time I go, I think I do a great job. And then my man Herb steps up and gives the next one, and I can't even begin to touch the feeling that Herb gives. But you and I go back a ways.
We do. We got a little history.
The first time I met you,
yes,
was we were at a reentry summit.
Correct.
At the Holiday Inn across the street over there.
That's right.
And the director of the Department of Corrections, Harold Clark, was there, and it was in the city of Charlottesville was there. It was a huge event. And this guy gets up there and starts telling this heartfelt story about how he was wrongfully convicted and he did prison time, and that happens more often than we would like to admit. And he gets up there and tells this story. Everyone's crying. And about how he got wrongfully convicted, and then he took questions from the audience, and you stood up and you said, "You must have the worst luck in the world because everything I've been convicted of, I did, plus a whole lot more." So that you weren't necessarily trying to be funny, but that told me that you had a gift.
Yeah, I had a gift of like keeping it real. I mean, that had been my story in the past. It wasn't often. In fact, I know of no time whatsoever that I was wrongfully convicted of anything. You know, I pretty much did what I did. And I had an attitude like, you know, police had a job to do, and I had a job to do. So my job was being criminal, and their job was to lock criminals up.
Well, let's start before that. So where are you from, man?
I'm originally from Newark, New Jersey. However, I was born right here in the wonderful state of Virginia, Chatham, Virginia, which is 29 South, right next door to Danville, Virginia. I came home with my mother some years ago so she could have me at my grandma's house. However, I only spent like 3 days there, and then I was off back up to New Jersey. But I was actually born here in Virginia, but I grew up in Newark, New Jersey.
So you grew up in Newark, New Jersey.
Yes.
When did you first? So, what's your drug of choice? Just to get that off the.
My drug of choice is high. I ended the career with heroin.
Okay.
I was first introduced to heroin many, many, many moons ago.
So, when did you When did you first start your what came first, the drugs or the behavior that led to incarceration, the sort of what we consider to be the property crimes?
Well, I would say that the lifestyle came before the actual use, because I was inducted as a young man at around maybe 1972, 1973. I was inducted into selling heroin on the streets of Newark, New Jersey.
Well, how old were you?
I was roughly around maybe 12, 13 years old at that time.
So the guys put you out there because they know kids don't get a whole lot of cop attention, and if the cops do pinch you, then it's just a 12-year-old doing that, and as long as you keep your mouth shut, there won't be a whole lot of ramifications.
Well, it went a little something like that, but, you know, it was more of an attraction to the lifestyle of those that sold drugs on the corner that I pretty much requested to be on the team, just like most of us did. You know, we weren't kind of like kidnapped and said, hey, man, come on out here and sell this. You know, we had a desire to want to sell.
Right. So in knowing you, and we'll talk about this more later, but the undercurrent with you is all self-responsibility. You make no excuses.
I do my best not to.
And when you do, you catch yourself.
I do sometimes.
Right.
I do sometimes.
So, you know, I just gave you an out of, you know, some older kids were telling you the way to be. And you're like, no, I was 12 years old. I knew what I was doing. I made those choices.
So, I did, in fact, make those choices, even in spite of the contradiction with my upbringing. Because at that time, I was attending Catholic school. I mean, I had all the privileges that you could have in a ghetto community. But I was just more attracted to the lifestyle of the, you know, the glam and the glitter of what I saw.
Well, tell me what happened next. When did you start going from sort of the salesman to the consumer?
Well, you know, I often wondered, you know, selling to a lot of people on the street, because during that time period, I think like most of the crowd that I served were a lot of men that had been returned back from war, from Vietnam. And I used to always wonder, you know, why these guys would press me so hard about getting this package. I mean, the only thing I knew was that something was contained in it. I knew that they were supposed to exchange money with me, mm-hmm. and that was pretty much it. And then, of course, I would watch them, you know what I mean, as the drug would take effect on them. But, you know, it always, you know, left me confused as to why did these dudes keep running up on me? Because, I mean, they would come to me at all times of the day, and it would just be constant and consistent. So
there must be something to it.
It had to be something to it, you know. Later on, I discovered it changed some feelings, you know, and that came much, much, much later on that I understood that. So as time went on, you know, curiosity killed the cat, you know. So I tried some. I tried some, and I tried a very, very small piece of it. And it changed every way of which I felt. You know, it made me more courageous. And I was like, you know, this is exactly what I need in my life.
I don't, I'm struck looking for a question.
Yeah.
How old were you then? You were 14, 15?
I was somewhere thereabouts, because I didn't start using immediately when I was younger, because it was just more about getting that money.
It was the hustle.
It was the hustle. I would think about maybe around 15, 16 years of age, I decided that I was going to go ahead and try it. I had already started smoking marijuana way before that. So I started smoking marijuana around maybe 13 years old. So it was kind of like at that time, it was a gateway for us to kind of like go and explore other drug usage.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about marijuana later, because I want to pick your brain, because you're actively engaged in recovery community, which those of you out there that don't know, the Charlottesville, Albemarle, and I will use the, because I'm not in recovery, I can say AA and NA, but the recovery community in Charlottesville is simply amazing. I've been to some of the meetings, I've supported some friends through there, and every time I go in there, I'm nervous going in, but I am elated coming out. It is the most powerful experience. Now I know why people go every day, because it's a high. It really is when you go in there and you have camaraderie and you hear people's stories and you're able to give of yourself to help others who you can look at and say, I was there. I know what you've been through. So How many? Well, I don't want to ask you that. That's an unfair question. So when did you first start getting in trouble? Trouble you couldn't get out of. Trouble that the gift of your of you, let's just say you have a gift of the spoken word.
Correct.
And you are smarter than your average bear. You're probably smarter than the average drug dealer out there. You're crafty. So when someone rolls up on you, you probably have a story that you will try to and I've been the recipient of one of those stories that you will try to put on somebody. And the people that you can you probably got out of some stuff that other people would not have gotten out of. So when did the trouble first start for you that you just couldn't get out of?
Well, I want to say, because you're right. The actual streets educated me in terms of wearing masks and disguises. So, I want to say maybe in my mid-20s, and at that time I had already left from New Jersey, and I ended up in Chicago. And I tried something different because I was not normally used to, like, working a gig every day. But I knew when I left New Jersey that I needed to change something. You know, I needed to change from the hustle mode I was in because I saw myself getting closer and closer to a long period of incarceration. So I was invited out to Chicago by my first wife, my youngest son's mother. And so I came there, and it was difficult for me to buy into the concept of like working every day. But fortunately, I was able to kind of like land a gig with Citibank. I had a cousin who was a bank manager out in Chicago who said, "Hey, listen, man, we're gonna try to hook you up with some change in lifestyle." And so he got me a job at the bank.
You were a banker?
I was a banker at one point. I was a banker back in 1983-84. I worked for Citi. At the time, it was Citicorp Savings because the savings and loans was jumping off during that time period. I got an opportunity to be a part of the pilot of the 24-hour banking program when 24-hour tellers were available, whereas you could actually speak to somebody 24 hours a day. So I did a pilot. Then later on, Citibank went on and incorporated it as a part of their customer service. And so I was one of the pioneers in that process. In any case, you know, working within confines like that, you know what I mean? I wasn't actually touching any money initially, but I did have the ability through the computer to kind of like, you know, move money in various places because I went in with a lot of fire and a lot of energy, as I do with most things that I do.
Everything.
And I learned
everything that I've everything. Ever known you do, whether it's sweeping a floor or giving a speech.
Hey, cleaning up behind other inmates, whatever it is, you know what I mean?
You give it your best. I will own that.
I do. And, you know, I owe a lot of that to my parents, you know, who kind of like gave me a pathway of like resilience. And to always, like, put your best foot forward, in spite of sometimes putting it in the wrong thing.
All right, you're holding on. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, apropos of something. I'm Jeff Leonard, sitting here with Kevin, sitting in for Ellen and Nancy today. We're talking about history. We're talking about addiction. We're talking about redemption with our friend Kevin. So you were working for Citibank in Chicago.
Correct.
Or City Savings and Loan.
Yeah, Citicorp Savings and Loan.
Okay.
That's kind of like the sister company of Citibank.
And you're in there moving money around on these computers.
I was. And I could start getting these ideas about, you know what, yeah, I could move some of this money into my own bank account. And I did. We were paid by, what do you call it, like when you get your money each month.
Direct deposit.
So what I would do is when I would run out of cash, what I would do is I would transfer some money to my bank account, and of course it would go in the negative. And whenever the direct deposit came through, it would make it positive again. So I was thinking, hey, well, listen, I'm not stealing from anybody, but at the time it was just wrongfully appropriated.
It was a faceless victim.
Wrongfully appropriating. That's what they call it, wrongfully appropriating funds. So, So that's what I did. So that was kind of like the beginning of how things were starting to come unglued. Because during that time period, while I was in Chicago, I met a lot of people that worked in the stock exchange, and I met some friends, and a lot of the guys at that time were doing cocaine. And there was a myth at that time, like if you were doing cocaine, that meant that you were somebody. You know,
it did have it, and still, I mean, powder cocaine has a bit of an elitist category.
Correct.
To it. Crack is for the street.
Correct. So, you know, my whole life I had always wanted to attach to something that gave me some sort of importance, because throughout the years, you know, I mean, I always felt like I wasn't good enough. I did come up during the civil rights movement. And so I was always kind of like challenged with like, well, who am I? You know what I mean? Who's going to like me? So I always attached to doing other things. So this way people would like me. And I felt like I was going to like myself in that process. But that didn't happen. That didn't happen.
So you got arrested in Chicago for taking, for wrongfully.
Actually, I did not. What ended up happening was is that I stayed at the job for about 3 years, and I did excel at what I did. I came very, very close to actually getting caught for doing it. But as I stated, I started using cocaine, so I would take off days that weren't announced. And after a while, the bank let me go because I was taking time off that I wasn't allowed to do. You had to take scheduled time during that time period.
Right.
We were around the clock, so you couldn't just call in and say, hey, look, I ain't going to be there today. And so from after so many absences, and of course with the inability to get up in the morning because I've been up all night, I eventually lost that job. But then, of course, that's just kind of like the beginning, and then it kind of like progressed into even deeper depths at that point.
Oh, man, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. I'm Jeff Leonard, sitting in with my friend Kevin. We're talking about redemption. We're going through his background a little bit. We're going to do about 2 more minutes, and we're going to take a break. So when did you leave Chicago?
I left Chicago like 1989. And I was going through so many changes at that time. My first wife felt like maybe perhaps I needed to be back in touch with where I was born. So that's how I ended up here in VA, and ended up in a little small town, which is called Danville, Virginia. And by the time I had arrived to Danville, I had kind of like graduated from like just the powder cocaine thing, and I had moved off into the crack thing. Both using and selling. I started off with selling because of cocaine. I wanted to kind of like replenish my money from my usage. And I brought the behavior down to Danville, Virginia, which was the wrong place to bring that behavior.
So at this time in your life, did you realize, I mean, had you come to even an inkling that this was a problem?
Well, I had been introduced to the fact that it was a problem because I had gotten into some domestic disputes with my wife when I was out in Chicago, spent a short period of time in jail, which I was introduced to recovery. I was placed in a TC program. I was serving like about maybe 5 months on a disorderly conduct as well as domestic violence, and I was introduced to recovery then.
All right, hold on. TC, you and I know what it is. It
right.
stands for therapeutic community.
In
1 minute, give our listeners a quick education, because the therapeutic community is going to come back up in our conversation. What is the TC?
Well, the TC program is something that's supposed to be connected with changing your behaviors, you know.
The behaviors behind the addiction.
Correct. Because, you know, as I grow in recovery, I have a better understanding of what recovery actually is. It's kind of like the inside out type job, you know what I mean? It kind of like gets you more comfortable with like some of the things that I discussed earlier about, you know, not feeling a particular way about something. And we kind of like use drugs to kind of like cover up the inability to actually feel through those things.
So the therapeutic community is a jail-based treatment system where everyone in the, it's a specific cell or pod of cells where everyone there is either been ordered there by the court or is there by desire to deal with the lifestyle choices that lead to addiction and result from addiction.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it's designed to attack the core of you know, where all these other things end up popping up. Because we realize today, you know, as a recovering person, I realize today that the usage of drugs is just a symptom. The disease itself resides within, on the inside, the way I think, the practice behaviors that I've kind of like reinforced throughout the years. So
it teaches you, as I understand recovery, every day is a gift, and no day is taken for granted. Today I am sober. That's where the I'm clean today comes from, correct?
Correct, it does.
And what TC and also the fellowships, AA and NA, teach you is to recognize the triggers early enough in your day and in your thought process and in your criminal thinking process to catch it before it leads to use.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. It doesn't always work that way.
I mean, but it's a matter of, you know, what sort of work are you actually investing into changing? I mean, what the programs do is that they help you to open up the opportunity of options in opposed to the same consistent thing that you always have done, which have always gotten you the same results, which we define that as insanity.
And it does it in a safe and supportive community of peers where no matter what you say you've done, they don't judge you.
No.
They offer you forgiveness. They offer you support.
Correct.
And they tell you it's going to be okay.
Correct.
Okay. All right. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll be right back. Apropos of something. Well, I did that in the wrong order. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Sorry about that. I'm Jeff Leonard, sitting in apropos of something. I'm with my man, Kevin. And during that break, two things happened. Kevin, one, wanted to dip out for a quick smoke. Didn't have time to do that. And two, his phone's blowing up.
Yeah,
get a little closer to that microphone.
Yeah.
Because people are texting him, telling him how proud they are.
Yeah. That's my little bro. His name is Barbara. You know what I mean? 2016, Berkmar Drive, right up from the do-it-yourself car wash and Jiffy Lube. Come on by and see us.
The barbershop's listening.
The barbershop is always listening. That's my family. That's the greatest support I have in this community. I have my little bro, Will Jones, you know what I mean, along with Fernando, Bear, RC, Dow, and Ray Ray, my team.
People don't understand in the African-American community, I didn't for a long time, I still probably don't, the sense of community that barbershops offer people like you who just want a safe place to go sit and talk about politics, talk about the weather, talk about your girlfriends, your wives, sometimes at the same time, talk about just what's going on in your life.
For sure.
And you're immensely loyal to the barbershops.
Man, I'm immensely loyal to my brother's barbershop, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because I get shown a lot of love, you know what I'm saying, in there. And likewise, I show love in exchange, you know, because, like, I'm never looked at in a judging sort of way. I'm confronted, you know what I mean? But it's always been a great deal of love, and I have people there that respect me, and they look up to me.
Well, you've earned that. I can tell you that. I mean, you've earned my love and respect. I can tell you that. So,
well, pay me then.
Pay you. I'll cut you on the radio, man. What more do you need? So we left off in Danville, and I get the sense that this is where the addiction took over.
Correct.
And the trouble just seemed to pile up one after the next, and you lost your freedom. Quite a bit.
I did. And I tell you a funny story about Danville, because prior to me committing the crimes, which I won't state what those crimes were, but prior to me committing those crimes, my brother at that time, who is deceased right now, was actually a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And I had went to my brother, and I was like, bro, my life was all to pieces. And he was like, listen, this is what we're going to do. We need for you to kind of like act like you're out of it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to call an ambulance for you. He said, now when they get here, you know what I mean, you got to act like you're really out of this thing, man. So I did. And he said, what they're going to do is they're going to get you some help. So what they did was they came and they placed me under what is called a TDO, which is a temporary detaining order. And they took me to Western State.
For addiction?
For addiction. I got to remember, man, we're talking about in the latter 90s. Okay. I mean, the latter 80s. You know, latter
they don't
80s.
Do that anymore.
No, they don't do that anymore. But back at that time, that's what they did. So what they did was they took me to this mental health facility, and they placed me in, you know, in the same quarters as those that were dealing with other issues, you know, mental health issues as well as substance use disorders. And they kind of like do an eval on it. So after the eval, they had made a recommendation that I go to this program, which was for recovering addicts. It was called a Turning Point. And they said, but in order for me to go, that where I came from, they would have to be responsible for paying for me to go. So what they did was they approached the city of Danville, and they said, hey, listen, he needs X amount of dollars to go through this program.
Thousands of dollars.
Correct. And Danville denied me. And when Danville denied me, they released me back into the community. And it was like maybe about another 3-4 months later, I had committed an offense which earned me 12 years in the Department of Corrections here in the lovely state of Virginia.
You did 12 years?
Well, no, that was my sentence. At that time, parole was in place.
Okay.
Parole was in place.
Before 1995.
Correct. But I would like to say this. You know what I mean? While I was in there, the Honorable Governor George Allen abolished parole.
Governor Jethro, as we referred to him around
here.
Yeah,
yeah. He abolished parole. And so I was left sitting in prison. I used to always get letters that say the parole board needs to see a longer period of development before entrusting you.
Yeah,
with
you
parole.
Got so you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard, station founder, sitting in for Ellen and Nancy. And apropos of something, we're listening to the styles and tribulations of a good friend of mine named Kevin. Kevin, you got screwed over on that.
I did. Because
I will tell you what happened. I mean, my background is I was a probation and parole officer for 26 years. And I remember when George Allen came in, he did away with parole through the General Assembly, but he also stopped all the discretionary parole.
Right.
So everybody like you who got sentenced to 12 years with the court thinking you're going to do a third of that, so
right.
they wanted to give you 3 years or
right.
4 years, they'd give you 12.
Correct.
You wound up probably doing 6.
Correct. That's exactly what I did.
And so you got hit too hard for you got overpunished. And when people get overpunished, what we know is that leaves
scars.
It does leave scars because punishment has certain therapeutic effects if administered appropriately. But if it's over-administered, then you do nothing but get angry.
And I was extremely angry because I was angry at the fact that at the time when I was willing to go forward with help, that I was denied.
The window was open.
The window was open, and I was denied that window because it was associated with a cost. But far more money was spent on me doing prison time than perhaps something that may have changed my life completely.
Let's talk about the change process for a second. The change process is you have to be open to change.
Correct.
Okay? And change... And your openness to change, that's we call that the window. And sometimes it's open and sometimes it's closed.
That's correct.
So in order for you to change, you've got to be, one, receptive to receiving the help.
Correct.
But also have that help available.
That's right.
And it sounds like through your life, it just didn't match up when you were ready for the change, it wasn't available. But when it was available, you weren't ready for the change.
That is so correct. That is so correct. And so... Of course, I developed a great deal of resentment, although, you know, I still had the ability to wear those masks. And I gave it a shot, a time or two, but I still carried the resentment scars. And that's the way I ended up landing here in Charlottesville, because I didn't have an address back in Newark, New Jersey. And so I kept asking guys, well, listen, man, why they keep turning me down? It was like, man, you got to find some place to live. So what they did, they gave me the address to the Piedmont House here in Charlottesville.
1600 Monticello Road.
That's right, 1600 Monticello Road. And I wrote to Piedmont House, and they said, we'll accept you. We shot that back in front of the parole board, and they said, parole granted. And that's how I ended up in Charlottesville.
So the Piedmont House is a halfway house for individuals who are transitioning out of the Department of Corrections, who might not have the most supportive of place to return to, or are frankly just homeless and they've got no place to be. And it sounds like that was your opportunity.
It was a turning point for me. It was a great turning point for me.
And I've worked with the Piedmont House for years, and not everyone that is it fair to say that not everyone that comes through there takes the opportunity like you did?
Well, I took the opportunity that was available to me at that time, because what I was looking for is, I just was looking for a place of my
own. You're looking to get out of jail.
Yeah,
get out of prison.
That's what I wanted to do.
No one can blame you.
Exactly. I wanted to get out of jail. But as I said it from the very beginning of this interview, you know what I mean? I already knew that I was going to be able to do great things once I got out of jail. I've never ever thought that I didn't have the ability to do that. However, once again, the inside stuff was not addressed yet. You know what I mean? Because it's easy at some points of your life to just remain substance free, you know.
But the behaviors and the thought process is still there.
Absolutely. So that's a dry drunk.
That's a dry addict.
Pretty much.
Not using, but it's not a matter of if, it's just when. It's just when it's going to happen.
Pretty much. I mean, anytime you're talking about, like you reinforce behaviors, man, for like 20, 30 years, you know what I mean? They just don't go away. I mean, you reinforce thinking, you know, and so that's been the greatest challenge, you know, on a daily basis. Because, you know, I still think crazy. I think crazy often.
You think fast.
I think fast.
Your brain.
I'm taught to think fast. I'm street hustling from street.
Your brain. I mean, you can just see your brain clicking. I mean,
all the time.
This is the longest I've ever seen you sit still. We've been here 34 minutes, and I've never seen you sit still this long.
I got a mask on right now.
Your mask. What is your mask you're wearing right now?
The mask I'm wearing right now just to sit still.
Is to sit still.
You're right.
Is to sit still and drop knowledge.
Correct.
Okay. So, but it's about this time that you and I came into each other's lives.
True.
And you and I had a bit of a rough patch there at about this point.
Correct.
And the rough patch was you were, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Apropos of something, I'm Jeff, sitting in for Ellen and Nancy, talking to my friend Kevin, and we were talking about you know, a lot of times. When guys get out of prison, ladies get out of prison also, they want to do great things. And they've had nothing but time. You've had 6 years to sit there and talk about all the things that you're thinking about, all the things you're going to do.
Right.
And then if you don't work on the internal stuff, when you get out and everything doesn't go your way, you're not prepared for when the setbacks begin to occur.
Absolutely.
So what happened?
You return back to the things that change the feelings, you know, and that's what I did.
The drugs.
That is correct. Went back to the drugs, looking for that to solve whatever I was going through at that period of time. And
you were married again.
I was. I did meet someone when I came to Charlottesville, and
who's a great lady.
She is a great lady, and
I met her at your apartment when I was looking for you.
Correct. You as well as many other officers who came looking for me.
Well, so our listening audience knows, when I was a supervisor again with probation and parole, I was as my son says, I watch people that watch people, and I met Kevin at the reentry summit, and you and I started a friendship at that point.
Right,
and we always sort of looked out for each other, and then your file came across my desk,
mm-hmm.
as someone who had returned to the behaviors, and that was sort of hiding out from us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go find you. And that's where I met your wife, was when I was banging on her door. And then I finally found you. And what happened when we came across each other?
I'm trying to remember that, man. You know, you remind me. Tell me what happened, man.
No, you started what you normally would do with just sort of your street hustle. Just the fast talking.
Yeah.
But your heart wasn't in it.
Yeah.
You were just, you know, you were saying what you thought you were supposed to say to try to get out of whatever you were into, but you could just tell that you were.
I was drained.
You were beaten. You were.
I was drained, man. I was drained, and it was difficult for me to recall that because, like, once again, my brain is kind of like healing off drugs right now, so it's a lot of stuff that I don't recall, but kind of like resonates a little bit because, like, I've done so much, man. It's kind of
you
hard.
Got so much more to give, though. So when we find, I had to make a decision,
right,
that I didn't want to make,
right?
Okay, and you wound up back
in jail.
But you came. I wasn't part of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I filled out some paperwork, but I wasn't part of the thought process.
Mm-hmm.
What happened at that point that changed your life?
You know, throughout the years, you know, I mean, none of anything that I've ever done really sat comfortably with me. Never. I mean, I'm talking about from the times when I first started hustling the streets. Cause like I had been given a foundation. You know what I mean? A foundation that was connected to principles. But as I stated, you know, I was more glamorized by what I saw in opposed to like some of the wonderful examples in front of me. Well, in any case, so I have been struggling with these thought processes for many, many, many years. And so it got to a place where, as I said, you know, man, I gotta do something different, man. I gotta do something different. I gotta figure out a way, like, to reconnect myself to the community. Cause like, I'm not no bad guy. I was having self-talks with myself. Not a bad dude, you know. And you could tell I wasn't a bad dude, because, I mean, many, many, many years ago, you mean it, nobody didn't really have to beg me for drugs when they had the money, you know what I mean? That's why I never made a good drug dealer, you know what I mean? I wasn't ruthless, you know what I'm saying? Like, I would always end up...
You took pity.
I took a lot of pity, and I took a lot of losses, too. I took a lot of L's for that pity, but...
But you sensed your gift was slipping away.
Exactly. And, I just
the gift of yourself, the gift that you have... To influence and impact others in a positive way.
True indeed, and I just felt like, you know, I have to find, you know, some way out of this trap, you know, because I had many moments of homicide and suicide, you know, and I didn't want my life to end that way. I didn't want my life to end that way. So that's when I kind of like connected with like, what could I do for myself? You know, and in so doing that, how can I pass it on to the rest of my brothers and sisters out there that went through similar struggles or that going through similar struggles like I am?
So you realize the biggest victim of your con was yourself.
Absolutely. It always had been, just like it is for so many of us in our communities. You
That's
know?
A low point, though.
See, it is a low point. It is a very low point. And especially, you know, considering, you know, all the things that, you know, many of us have had to live through. You know what I mean? And that's of any hue. You know what I'm saying? It ain't just like just my hue, you know, because there's many others that, you know, are from various ethnic backgrounds, you know what I mean, that have similar experiences. You know what I mean? So.
All right. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard sitting in. We're Ellen and Nancy with Apropos of Something. When we get back, I want to talk about drug court. You down for drug court?
Come on with it.
Shout out to Fernando.
That's right.
Texting in.
That's right. AKA Detail. What's going on, boy?
94.7 WPVC. I'm Jeff Leonard, and this is Apropos of Something. Where we left off was about 2 years ago. Almost three years ago. Kevin realized that the biggest victim of his cons was himself.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in jail.
Well, actually, I realized I ain't want to go back to the penitentiary no more. That's what I realized.
So it was self-serving on a couple levels.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, you got to be self-protectionist as well. I don't get a little closer to that mic if you don't mind. So, so this thing came up called drug court.
Correct.
And you entered into drug court, and I'm gonna go out on a limb here and say you entered into drug court to get out of jail rather than to get better. Is that fair?
Well, let's do it in like some percentages, you know.
Okay.
What I mean?
There we go.
The greatest percentage is not to go back to the penitentiary yet again for the fourth time.
Fair enough.
Also too, there was a desire to want to do something different, and I knew that it would have to begin with me stopping the use of illicit drugs.
So the window is opening and closing. Sometimes the desire was just to be out. Sometimes the desire was to get better.
That's correct.
Okay. And it wasn't easy for you initially.
No, it wasn't easy at all.
What was so hard about it?
It was the obsession and the compulsion to use, you know. I recall when I first started that, you know, I was out there. I was out there. You know what I mean? At that time, I was using drugs intravenously. And, of course, it had become like a around-the-clock type deal for me.
Did you ever think you'd get there? I mean, I don't think anyone, any heroin addict ever thinks, I'm going to grow up and stick a needle in my arm.
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. Because, like, initially when I started using heroin some many, many moons ago, I did not use it intravenously. I used the nose channel. But then later on, you know, I had moments where, as you know, I kept watching those that, you know, injected themselves, you know what I mean? Because I always thought that thing was going to be, like, painful, you know what I mean? Ain't want nobody poking me. But later on, somebody said to me, of course, there's always somebody going to say something to you, like, this is the best way ever to experience it. So I took a shot at it, and the rest of it was history.
Let's just say it's the most effective way to experience it.
The most effective way to experience it.
So you went into
drug court.
You went into drug court.
For sure.
And didn't stop using.
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. In fact, you know, drug court has this these guidelines of which, you know, there's accountability. There's accountability for some of your behavior. So if in fact if you use, you know, at various levels, then there's some accountability for it. So what I read on my paperwork was that if you use for the first time, you would only get 1 day in jail.
Right. There are affirmative sanctions.
Correct.
For each use. So
correct.
You did the calculus in your brain.
Correct.
That if I use once.
Right.
Then I get this. If I use twice.
I just only had 1 day in jail. So my wife, who was there at that time, I said, baby, listen, I said, I'm not feeling real good about this. You know what I mean? I got to do something. I got to get high. She was like, are you kidding me? I said, listen, I only got to spend 1 day in jail, man. Look how much time I spend in jail all throughout my life. I could do 1 day. So she was like, you got to be kidding me. I said, man, I got to do it. So I convinced her for about maybe 2 hours. And then she finally went on and said, hey, I wore her down because, like, I really did not want to displease her. But I wore her down. She was like, go ahead, do whatever you're going to do. And that's what I did. I got high. And so they tested me when I went to the facility that handles the testing. And I didn't admit to it. I was like, I didn't do it. So they said, okay, we're going to send it all to the lab. So what I did was I asked some other fellow drug court participants, how long does this thing take to come back from the lab? They said, it'll take about maybe 7 days. So what I did was I used heroin for the next 7 days.
So you saw the window.
I saw the window, and I went for it.
So what did it take for you? So you've been clean 2 years, 2 months, and 28 days.
Yeah.
What was that? What turned in your mind to say, this is the longest period of sobriety you've had, unincarcerated sobriety you've had since you were probably 13, correct?
And I would say since I've been about 30.
Okay.
Since about 30.
And you're 104 now, so that's no.
Listen, man, don't be telling my age. You know what I mean?
So what was that? What was the tipping point? What was the decision point on that? Was it a sponsor? Was it someone coming in your life that said enough is enough, or was it a combination of sort of internal and external factors?
I wouldn't say that it was a combination of internal external factors. One of them being that I had grown to a place where, as I had gotten tired of abusing myself, I didn't necessarily do this on the strength of like wanting to make other people happy. You know, I just had got tired of, like, abusing myself because, you know, it was difficult for me to get comfortable with, like, just being, like, a scumball, you know what I mean? That never sat well because I've always taken at periods when my head was together, I've taken a great deal of pride in what I represent. So it had kind of, like, worn me down, and I was like, man, you got to do something different. And the experience from taking that initial step kind of like opened up like a floodgate of other things of which were pretty much contained that I didn't really look at. And they kind of like started to bubble forth like, hey, this is a good reason to be clean too. Here's another good reason to be clean. And it kind of like developed over time and it still continued to develop. And I continue to work on those things because when I lose that grip of what else do I need to be clean for, then it's easy for me to slip back into the reasons that I don't need to be clean.
So you've always been someone that I've considered to be a cheerleader for others.
Yeah.
You have supported your friends through thick and thin.
Yeah.
At the expense of yourself. And
sometimes.
And even when you were in drug court and you weren't giving it your best effort, you were still cheerleading others who were giving it their best effort.
Yeah.
So at some point, you turned all of that motivation toward yourself.
Inward, yeah.
Inward, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's when your wife noticed.
Yeah.
That's when I noticed. That's when the world noticed that your gift was back.
No doubt. Keep watching. Keep watching. Yeah, keep watching.
You're not done by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I mean, as long as I wake up each day, you know what I'm saying, I'm going to do my best to give it my best shot. Number one, you know, the number one thing on my plate each and every day is don't use. Don't use. You know what I mean? Because, like, using is not going to change what's about to go down, because life going to continue to show up each and every day.
Right.
So as long as I don't, like, fog my judgment any more than it's already fogged, then things have a way of working themselves out as long as I get out of my
dealing
own
with
way.
Life on life's terms.
Dealing with life on life's terms.
Hey, turn around for a sec. Who's this coming in?
This is it.
Talk to the microphone.
I got my grandbaby from North Carolina in the house.
Your granddaughter and your beautiful wife here. Come on in and have a seat, guys. You want to come in and chat with?
You know what I mean?
So one of the things that was most remarkable about you.
Yes.
One of the minute you got to get closer to the microphone because you're about to tear up probably.
All right.
One of the things is everyone that comes in contact with you just falls in love with you.
I don't know why either,
but it happened to me too. So you took a gig at when you're in drug court.
Yes.
Can I say where you work now?
Absolutely.
So you took a community service gig.
Correct.
At the Haven.
At the Haven, 112 West Market Street. Yeah. Come by and holler at us. Yeah.
And you took a gig at the Haven.
Yeah.
Now unpaid.
Unpaid.
And you were sweeping floors, cleaning up for addicts,
cleaning up for everybody,
just like in prison. And you were there, and then they suddenly realize what most people realize that come in contact with you is they can't live without you.
Yeah.
So they hired you.
They did. They did indeed. They hired me. They loved me. They embraced me. They encouraged me. He did all those things and continued to do them to this very day.
They support you each and every day.
Each and every day.
And it's from my perspective, it looks like it's important to you to help, because you're helping people that were where you were 2 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
I have daily reminders of what I used to look like on a day-to-day basis, you know, which helps me to be more in touch with, you know, what my folks out there are going through. You know what I mean? That's where that humility comes in. And that humility is like, you know, always looking at myself to be an equal to every being that's on this planet. You know what I mean? And I wish that could be like the, you know, the vibe of the entire world. You know what I'm saying? But that's the way I look at folks on a day-to-day basis. And through me extending myself, giving myself to others, you know what I mean, then it helps to heal me.
But one thing, I agree, I don't want to say but the thing that I notice about you is that you've taken this sobriety and you've taken this power that you've always had, but now that it is focused, and you've become an activist. I mean, you said you were raised in the civil rights era.
Absolutely.
And you are channeling your experiences and
that same energy
for so much good. I mean, August 12th,
yeah,
you were on the steps of the Haven,
yeah,
fighting back the Nazis,
yeah,
keeping them out of your sanctuary, keeping them out of your safe spot.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was like you know, like a repeating history, you know what I mean? Because I already seen that before, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like I said, I'm from Newark, New Jersey. I'm from Brick City. You know what I mean? I have watched, you know, riots and everything just like be totally off the chain. I have been sent into areas of like martial law. Nobody don't know nothing about that, whereas you gotta stay in your house. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like nothing like I had never seen before, you know. I just approached it in a different manner. And I really wasn't there to take on the folks that were down there. I just was there to help protect the people that I had a responsibility.
Right, you were there to protect the people that didn't have the ability to protect themselves.
For sure.
And you and Herb were out there.
We were front line.
And it went down right on your front steps.
Right in front of our nose.
Oh my God! I don't know what that. I can't imagine what that must have been like for you guys.
Well, it took a great deal of composure. You know what I mean?
Because you wanted to kill him.
We don't state nothing like that on the air, man.
I mean, it would be normal to have great fits of rage and anger directed toward people that didn't see you as equal and did not and were there to do harm.
Well,
is that fair to say?
Not really, because, you know, I've seen that before, man. That's unproductive. It's unproductive, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, the anger, so on and so forth. It's always unproductive.
How do you channel something like that into a productive motivation for your sobriety?
See, you wouldn't ask me something that requires much more thought than we have time for.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. About 54 minutes past the hour, I am with my friend Kevin and his beautiful grandbaby and wife, who's sitting over in the corner.
Sugar Bear in the building.
And I just wanted to give him a little chance to think about how you channel something like A12 into anything that motivates you to do better.
Well,
you got to get closer to that mic, man.
Well, you know, I think the best way for me to channel it is, you know, to like continue to do what I do and represent as who I am. Because I realized today that, you know, any change begins with me. It don't begin with a populace. You know what I'm saying? It starts with me. And then hopefully, you know, in my representation, what it'll do is it'll affect someone else. You know what I'm saying? Whereas maybe they might want to copy, you know, what they see. You know, just like in the earlier years, I copied some things that didn't necessarily turn out to be really, really productive for me. But I'm just hopeful that, you know, by through my example, you know what I mean, not through my words, because I can't kick it a lot, you know what I'm saying? But it's just through my example, through my footwork, you know what I mean, that it might inspire somebody else to do something different.
Well, the serenity prayer sort of helps, too.
It does.
You control what you can control.
Exactly. I won't control everything, though. I just keep 100, you know what I mean? But I know I'm not able to.
Yeah, giving up that control probably was for me, that would be the hardest part.
It's still a constant daily challenge.
You catch yourself in those moments of trying to control things beyond your ability?
Sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes I curb. You know what I mean? I go out there with it, you know? And then later on, I get an opportunity to think about it and say, well, you know what? Next time I'm presented with something similar, let's try to do something different.
That makes sense. So we've got about 4 minutes to go. Is there anything that we haven't covered? I mean, I've spent too much time today talking about the stuff that you've done in your history, but yeah. I want to spend some time talking about what your future looks like, because you, as I've said a couple of times, you just have this gift that people want to be around you, and you are such a positive role model. What's next?
Well, down at the Haven, you know, we are trying to, no, we're not trying, we're framing some stuff that we hope that will be very uplifting to the community. We do have on the plate to do some live entertainment down at the Haven, like coming up after the first of the year. Also, too, we want to get the community involved in various support groups. We haven't actually come up exactly with what each individual support group will be about. Where I have a team of people right now, we're working together in the laboratory to come up with things that can serve to elevate the community.
Because you've got a venue down there. You've got that old sanctuary space is
absolutely
glorious.
That's my house.
And you've protected that house.
Exactly.
And that house has protected you.
It has indeed. You know, and right now I got the keys to the street. You know what I'm saying? They were given to me, and I'm going to do my best to utilize them in the most productive and positive way as I possibly can.
This is one of those sad times that I wish we were on television, because your grandbaby just came in and gave you a big hug, tell you she loves you.
Yeah.
How are you not tearing up?
Now I'm not tearing up. That's my, that, I'm going to see my baby again. You know what I mean? That, this is what we do. That's what we do.
So you want to take your, you want to take the folks that you know through recovery and the yes. folks that you know. And one of the reasons, I built this radio station was to get people that you come across in Charlottesville's downtown mall that have stories to tell like yourself of redemption, of power, of overcoming both things that they've done themselves and things that they've had done to them, and get their stories out there. Because when you turn the news on, the news, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. The news is miserable. Man. There's enough of that nonsense out there. But I want to hear stories about this. I want you to come back when you... when you have your open mic nights, or when you have these events at the Haven, where all these people come together and celebrate life on life's terms,
I do it. You know, and you know, and that's an extension to, you know, each and every one that's in the community. It's not necessarily, you know, I'm saying, for a particular group like those that, you know, suffer from substance use disorders. You know what I mean? Because, you know, we all out here today suffering from something in one way or another, and you know, we as a community, if we could just kind of like group and vibe and develop like some real true positive energy, you know what I mean, then hey, the goal has been met.
Right, but it breaks down the stigma, you know, it breaks down the stigma of substance abuse disorders, mental health disorders.
Correct.
If when you see people who suffer from things that people that look like me struggle to understand, but you see them doing great things despite being put behind the eight ball, as it were.
Yeah.
It really is heartening. All right, man. You got 18 seconds. What do you got to say?
Hey, in my 18 seconds, I like to thank everybody for tuning in to 94.7 FM, you know what I mean, to hear me chop it up a little bit about what my life has been about. I hope that I entertained anybody that was listening, or I hope that I brought somebody closer to the understanding of the lifestyle of which I've lived. I'd like to send a shout-out once again to His Image Barbers. Right out there, that's on Brookmar Drive. Come and see us, man, for the freshest cut in the neighborhood.
Let's remain FCC compliant.
All right, let's be
94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard. I've been sitting in for Ellen, my friend Kevin. Kevin, I'm so proud of you, my man. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, man.
Peace. Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.